Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The Resurrection Pass Trail is a gem. Running from Hope to Cooper Landing, this 38-mile route is probably Alaska's best backpacking trail, but it's also great for mountain biking, snow machining, skiing, snowshoeing, and running. On today's show, we'll learn about using the trail for a variety of adventures, from a week-long hike with kids, your backpack, your tent, maybe renting a cabin or two, to a running event that does the whole thing and back in a single day. I hope you'll be inspired to get out in our backyard and enjoy this wonderful part of Chugach National Forest. My first guest today is Thomas, who is the race director of this amazing foot race that goes all the way over the Resurrection Trail, 38 miles, and then add some other miles so that you can either do the 50 or 100 mile event. And this is kind of like taking your whole feast and eating it all at one bite, it seems to me. I mean, most people will do this trail in several days, but these guys are doing the whole thing in essentially one day, right, Laren?
Yeah, one day. Most people's goal for 100 miles would be under 24 hours, and certainly there's been people who've beaten that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Sounds pretty tough. So tell me about, you've done the trail not as a racer as well, right?
Right, yeah. I've hiked the trail numerous times and run on the trail and trained on the trail. I love getting up there and enjoying what Alaska has to offer on our trail systems.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've been on all the other trails in South Central Alaska or an awful lot of them. I mean, because you're a mountain runner and a pretty avid hiker.
Right, right.
So what's special to you about this trail? It was obviously a historic trail, and it gets you up into the Alpine, and it's got a variety. I mean, what sort of excites you about the Resurrection Trail?
The Resurrection Trail, I mean, the trails down on the Kenai Peninsula are very different from the trails up here in the Anchorage area. They tend to be more rolling, less steep. There's long valleys that you get to go through nice mountain passes that don't take tons of work to get up through, like some of these jagged ones here in the Chugach up near Anchorage. So in that way, it's really nice. You just get some nice long views and meadows of wildflowers, and it's pretty awesome in those ways. You still get some mountains, but usually you don't head straight up the mountains. You get to kind of float, I guess, in a sense. You're just floating along running rather than putting your hands on your knees and trying to plow up these big climbs.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, our Chugach Mountain trails are pretty much all have some kind of a sort of a, unless you get to drive to the top before you begin, like Glen Alps, you're pretty much, you know, huffing and puffing your way up, and there's not that much smooth hiking. I guess there's the Glacier Creek, Winter Creek Trail out in Girdwood, mm-hmm. which is pretty level, but not very long.
Right,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, not too many other choices. I mean, the thing about Resurrection Pass is that it was the reason it's there is as transportation, right? It was these gold miners who were trying to get to Hope and starting out in Seward, and they're looking for the easiest route. They're not looking for the most challenging route.
Right. Yeah, they find those easy routes through the mountains. It's amazing that over the years, you think about some of the trails that have been made, how they did find those easy routes and how it must have been passed on. And it's like, go this way, and they just follow those routes and make the trails for us to enjoy in the future, I guess.
Yeah. Well, in the second half, we're going to have some folks from the Forest Service to talk about sort of the history of the trail, how it came into existence and how it's maintained and the connecting trails and stuff like that. But I want to talk a little bit more about this really difficult race, which sounds like it's one of the only ultramarathon races in Alaska during the summertime. True?
We have a couple summertime ultramarathons in South Central Alaska. It's mm-hmm. the only ultramarathon we have. A lot of the races here in South Central Alaska tend to be very short, up to the top of a mountain, like Bird Ridge Climb or Mount Marathon.
Right.
Sometimes the downhill, like Mount Marathon. And then there's some longer kind of road runs, like the Mayor's Marathon, Half Marathon, so on and so forth. But there's not a whole lot of... in fact, I mean, it's the only ultra marathon, meaning longer than 26.2 miles. And we have two versions, the 50-mile and the 100-mile version. 100-mile version where you get to see the whole trail twice, essentially.
That's brutal.
Yeah.
So to set the geography for folks, the north end of the trail is in Hope, which is on a spur off of the Seward Highway. And the south end of the trail is in Cooper Landing. And it's 38 miles by trail by foot between those two points. How do you get a 50 and 100 mile run out of that?
Oh man, that was a challenge. And over the years, the course has changed a little bit. And when I took over, this is my third year as the organizer, race director, I've changed the course as well. But I wanted it to be mainly on the trail systems that we have there. And so after quite a bit of thinking, I finally figured out a way I could do not only a 50 miler, but a 100 miler too. And I think the 50 miler is even harder than the 100 miler. But basically, they start at the Hope post office, run to the trail, and then they run the trail all the way to Cooper Landing. From there,
so that gives them like 42 miles.
42 miles,
like 4 miles from the post office to the trailhead, and then 38 to Cooper Landing.
Right, and then they turn around there, run back up towards Resurrection Pass. They get to, there's a Devil's Creek cabin where the Devil's Creek Trail comes in.
Mm-hmm.
There they take a right, head down the Devil's Creek Trail all the way to the bottom, which is about 10 miles.
The Devil's Creek Trail, that comes out near Turnigan Pass on the Seward Highway, or where does that come out?
South of there, yeah. Kind of by Summit Lake.
Okay.
A few miles south of the Summit Lake area.
So it's sort of like a spur, and it ends up on the highway as
right.
well. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that pretty steep, that section, that Devil's Creek?
It's a little more, it's a little steeper than the Resurrection Pass Trail, a little more rocky, technical, in general than the Resurrection Pass Trail.
Uh-huh.
But it's a nice addition to the trail, I think.
Okay.
And you see the similar type of surroundings in that area as well.
So how many miles does that spur add on?
It adds on 20 miles, essentially. So you do the 10 miles down and the 10 miles back up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then back to Hope at that
yep.
point?
Back down to Hope, and the finish is... I love it because it's right over the bridge, over the creek there to the parking lot is where it finishes.
So that gives you 100 miles.
100 miles, yeah.
So have you done a 100 mile? I mean, you've done this before, right?
I have run 100 miles. I've not run the Resurrection Pass 100 miler yet. In fact, this summer I get the opportunity because a couple ladies who are big in the ultra running and running community offered to take over the race day duties so that I could run the 100 miler this summer or give it a try.
Do you think you have a slightly sadistic bent that you send people off to do this 100 miler and you don't do it yourself?
Oh man, I think. So I think there's a part of that in us, you know, that we know that there's going to be some suffering out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be hard. It's going to be challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes it does hurt a lot.
Well, I mean, the marathon is really a pinnacle sort of achievement for a lot of people. You know,
yeah,
to say you finished a marathon is really to say something. And this is almost four times as much. It's almost inconceivable, but you're not... Are you really running that whole time? I mean, are you... Tell me about how you even do that.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's no, like, one way to approach it. There's a lot of... you know, in marathon running, there's a fairly straightforward ways to approach the marathon. Some people actually do walk and run it, and some people run all the way through. Of course, if you want to race, you're going to be going
run
all
fast.
Out the whole
yeah.
way. 100-mile races are a completely different ballgame. And... it kind of go based on who you are and what you want to accomplish. Running a full 100 miles straight would be extremely tough to do. Most people spend some time hiking or walking as well as running. And of course, even some time sitting at the aid stations to make sure you eat a lot of food. In 100 mile running, more than others, you have to make sure your nutrition is up. So drinking a lot of water, eating a lot of food. I mean, even to the point of some people, pizza and, you know, all these different,
mm-hmm.
you know, things that you wouldn't think of for running, turkey dinner even, you
right.
know, to the point of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so fast hiking, jogging, you mm-hmm. know, but you're still probably going really light. You're not carrying much with you.
Right, yeah, you try to go as light as possible for sure. Here in Alaska, and for this race in particular, you have to go a little heavier than in outside races. We have a little bit more cold to deal with. It's a lot longer from trailhead to trailhead than in a lot of other places. They go without any aid or any help for, you know, up to 38 miles on the trail. So they have to be ready for rain and wind, which we've had in past years, a lot of it. We've also, you know, they have to be ready to keep eating and keep their energy up to be able to make it that far.
A heck of a lot can go wrong, you know, in a 38-mile
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hike or especially run. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Ankles or, yeah, stomach issues are big issues.
Do you have a sweeper who comes along after to make sure everybody's okay? Or how do you deal with the safety aspect?
Well, one of the safety aspects I deal with, of course, that is a huge issue. Over the last couple of years, I have a lot of volunteers, and these races are really made by the volunteers, and so they're the ones to, you know, we're really thankful for all those people who are helping out. We have people at various spots on the course, not peppered throughout the course because we can't get that many volunteers, but usually I have a couple of volunteers that are willing to go up to Devil's Pass. And yeah, they do kind of end up sweeping the course and seeing and making sure. And we have volunteers at a couple other key spots.
I would think that you'd have people, I mean, you obviously would have twisted ankles and people need that kind of help, but you might have people just like run out of steam, just exhaustion. Does that ever happen?
Thankfully, we have had people, I mean, exhaustion is just a part of the game. I've never had that issue before where somebody just laid down and fell and didn't get back up kind of thing. And I think, you know, in training for these, you learn how to deal with that exhaustion. That's probably one of the most important things with training. So even though you're exhausted, just to know that if I just keep putting one foot in front of the other and I walk, I will eventually get there.
Yeah. Let's talk about that psychological. It sounds like that's probably one of the biggest parts of this is just having the attitude that you are going to make it no matter what, and you're just going to keep going no matter how bad it hurts.
Yeah, absolutely. Psychologically, I think 100 miles, 50 miles, the ultra marathon distances psychologically tend to be more taxing than even physically, because yeah, it is going to be hard. It is going to hurt a little bit, maybe a lot. But still, you know, you have to have the mental capacity to stay positive and just to keep moving and keep going. And sometimes it feels like it's impossible. You're never going to get there. But if you keep that mindset where one foot in front of the other, eventually you will get there. And it's amazing what you can do when you have that mindset going.
You know, it's interesting because I've doing the show for the last few years, I've noticed that when I interview extreme endurance athletes, they always are super cheerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, they I think you need to have kind of an optimistic view of the world in order to do this, because you know, you can always, I mean, it just takes one moment of doubt to quit, right? You got to sort of have a positive outlook the entire time through this whole ordeal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, and I think in general, we find that there are times in these races that you're up and you're doing really good. And then there's times that you're down and you don't feel good. And you do want to quit, and you have to find those ways to overcome those challenges, those difficulties. And those are psychological barriers that you have to overcome in these races. And I think in one way, and in many ways, you can apply those to your life in general and the obstacles and challenges you face in your life.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about. Is that do you find that that's a transferable skill? I mean, what situations have you found yourself in where that's paid off?
Oh man, I think just in, like you mentioned, your general demeanor and the way I approach things is much different. I definitely don't approach things with the view that, oh, it's going to be impossible. I always have that view that, I tend to have that view more that, oh, it is possible. I can do it, you know. That I guess that you gain some confidence that we have this innate ability to carry out these tasks, you know. So
yeah, I guess when you have accomplished something that is extreme or is at the very edge of your abilities, then things that follow never seem that hard, right? Everything gets easier in comparison once you've done that, and and you build that sort of sense of your own identity, I guess, that's built on something.
I think that's a good point. Yeah, you kind of learn more about yourself in that way, kind of a deeper truth about yourself and the way you think, the way you feel, all that stuff.
Yeah, interesting. And you're a teacher, so that must be something that you think about when you're trying to instill some of those values in kids.
Oh yeah, absolutely. All the time trying to figure out ways and learn new ways to instill those kind of values in
get them to stretch themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Challenge themselves. Persevere through difficult times.
Mm-hmm. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking about the Resurrection Trail today. My guest is in this half is Laren Thomas, who's the race director of this ultra marathon race that uses the trail. And also, Laren is just a lover of our trails around South Central, and it's always just fun to talk about these places. I'm Charles Woolforth, and in the second half, we're going to also hear from folks who manage the trail and about the history of the place. And I think that, you know, it would be fun to talk a little bit about sort of the profile of the trail. You know, where what it's, you know, there's a series of cabins. There's sort of a changing biome that you pass through, you know, going from sea level and up into the mountains.
Yeah.
You start out in Hope, which is kind of a really cool community. I think people forget about it coming from Anchorage. It's on that little spur road. Doesn't take that long to get there. Right. Get there from Anchorage. There's good fishing in the stream there for salmon, and there's a really nice campground there, that Porcupine Campground that overlooks Turnagain Arm. And then there's also a couple of good trails. One that reads out to Gull Rock, which is really level. And then there's also a sort of lung buster that goes straight up the mountain there. Yeah. So three different trails you can do from Hope, and cafes and sort of funky little community. There's a great little museum there. So it's really worth going, and there's place to stay, little cabin, you know, places you can stay, and a good place to start a hike. Of course, if you're going to do the Resurrection Pass Trail, you have to have a vehicle or somebody to pick you up on the other end, or do like Laren does, just run all the way and then run all the way back. But that's not recommended for families. So what's the first section of the trail like, Laren?
The first section of the trail tends to be a little bit more, wooded. You're kind of in the lowlands, wooded. You often hear the creek because it's a little bit, a little more water in it. You see those, you know, just more tree life and the animals and stuff that mm-hmm. go along with that tree life, porcupines and sometimes bears. And
yeah. do the runners carry bear spray? And I mean, because running can be in bear country, it's a bit more dangerous than hiking because you come up upon the bear a lot faster.
Absolutely. There are a lot of people who swear by bringing bear spray when they go out and run. And there's various, you know, there's also foghorns. People will carry those sometimes. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure when you're traveling through bear country. So mm-hmm. Especially when you're running through it, I think it's advisable to have something like that. Or I actually personally don't carry that, but I'm always making a lot of noise and trying to make my presence known, as well as being aware of my surroundings, you know, any smells or anything that might be happening.
Yeah, there was a great mountain runner, Marcy Trent, who lost her life on the
McHugh Creek Trail,
McHugh Creek Trail, mm-hmm. when she came upon a bear that was feeding, and so that's always something we need to be really aware of when we're running. What about bugs? I mean, when you're doing a mountain run, do you get through the mosquitoes fast enough that they don't alight, or do you dose up? Or what?
That's
do you
one
do?
Of the big appeals to running through the mountains is, especially in Alaska.
Mosquitoes can't keep up with
you. Yeah, they can't keep up with you. You just got to run faster than those mosquitoes.
Well, that's your great incentive not to walk, right?
Exactly.
Keep running.
Because, once you walk or stop, they're all over you in hordes.
So you come through that wooded area, and then you start a fairly gradual ascent, right?
Yeah, very, very gradual ascent. Trail's really nice. Tends to be fairly smooth, not huge rocks everywhere, so it's not super technical, where you have to jump around and dance around the rocks the whole way up. However, when it is raining, it does get really muddy and a lot of little standing pools of water on the trail. But when it's nice, you just kind of stroll up. It feels like, you know, it's a very gradual ascent. You have, over that section, you have like 19 miles to go up into Resurrection Pass proper, and, only a couple thousand feet of elevation gain.
Yeah, so that's really gentle. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not that much of, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not remembering that there's a real turnaround point if you want to do a day hike from that end.
Right.
You're kind of just in the woods.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there's no real big spot from the Hope side in particular. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a few cabins along the way and such, and but yeah, no real turnaround until you get up into the pass in particular. I feel.
Anyways. Yeah, and we'll talk about the cabins and camping in the second half with the Forest Service folks. But so it's 19 miles to break out of the tree line.
I believe
roughly or something like that.
You break out of the tree line a little quicker than that, for sure. I don't know what mileage exactly, but yeah, you break out of the tree line, and it's a, you know, it's a gradual process where it becomes more alpine tundra. And me personally, in particular, I just love the alpine tundra when you're above those trees and everything's open. The seasons change the colors of the grasses. It's really green this time of year, but as the fall comes around, you get those yellows and reds, and it's amazingly beautiful terrain.
It is a great fall hike, and it also, because of the kind of gentle rise, it's a really good wintertime trip. You can do it on cross-country skis pretty easily, or certainly on snowshoes, and I don't think there's a ton of avalanche danger. We'll check in with the Forest Service on that in the second half, but I think in general the trail is pretty far from any steep slope, so it's not something where you have to have any technical avalanche knowledge for wintertime trips. All right, so you get up to the alpine,
Then you get to go through the pass, and when you get through the Resurrection Pass, of course, they have a little sign there that says the elevation gain, and you really have that feel of up in the mountains. Then, you know, you can see a long ways, and then you head down, and you get to just kind of coast down the hill. I feel, you know, it's just kind of nice, easy downhill, not a steep downhill, and most of the way, and you just get to. Just get to roll with it. It feels the second half as you get up north, or I mean south, as you head south towards Cooper Landing, you actually get a lot more lakes, and there's a few beautiful lakes in the area that you get to pass and run right next to, even on the course.
Do you ever stop for a swim when you're out hiking? I think that's like the most delicious thing when you're like on a hot day, you know,
absolutely.
Plunge in. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. At least, you know, even if you're trying to go fast, take a dip, quick dip, and
not when you're when you're doing a race, maybe not, but yeah.
Well, sometimes you get a little bit overheated. It's like, oh yes, I need a little bit of a break here.
And then it sort of starts winding down, gets a little bit steeper and switchbacks as it gets closer to Cooper Landing, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's actually two sections of switchbacks. One is just before you get to some of the lakes down there. I think right near Swan Lake is one steeper section, and then there's another steeper section right before you get down to Cooper Landing after you pass all the lake country.
So then if
stuff.
You're racing, then you have to turn around and run right back up that, huh?
Yeah, then you have to run right back up, but you're like, yeah, everything I'm going down, I'm going to have to come right back up in a few minutes.
So in the spur trail is a bit steeper, right?
Yeah, the Devil's Creek Trail, which is also a part of the Resurrection Pass Ultra races, is a bit steeper. Over instead of, you know, 19 miles gaining the same elevation, you gain it in 10 miles, within 10 miles. And most of that actually is over the last seven, I would say, because you start off by going from the highway, you actually head downhill quite a ways, and then you have to head back up.
So, does that meet the Resurrection Trail sort of near the midpoint of it, or more towards the Cooper
Pretty
Landing?
Much right at the midpoint. The Devil's Creek Cabin, Devil's Pass Cabin is, I think, like, I mean, it's a mile away from Resurrection Pass. It's very close.
So it's kind of similar scenery.
Yeah, very similar scenery. It actually is a bit steeper. You run up above kind of a ravine on the Devil's Creek Trail for a bit of the way, and so... It's very similar scenery, mountains around and everything, but actually a little rockier, a more steeper ravine kind of there. And there's actually a couple of, like, there's a waterfall that falls right on the trail, which is kind of cool as well.
Yeah.
And that's our turnaround point, in fact, for the 50-mile race.
All right. So you're planning to run this year, and what's your goal?
My goal is to finish.
All right.
I have a number of goals. Personally, I'd really love to be under 20 hours in a 100-mile run. So that would be a huge accomplishment if I could do that. 24 hours is always within a day. 100 miles within a day is always a big accomplishment. Neither of which I have accomplished in my life
so
yet.
Cutting 4 hours off would be pretty big. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be awesome. But you know, 24 hours would be awesome too.
What's the longest people do? Or do you have a cutoff for how long it can take you?
Personally, I stay there until I know the whereabouts of everybody that's running. Last year, That ended up being like 11 at night. So we started at 3 on Friday, and I stayed there until 11 the next day on Saturday.
Yeah.
One lady was, she spent a lot of time walking and came out quite late.
So like for a 31 mile or something, like 31 hour trip or something like that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was just kind of, I was, you know, rooting people on, giving food and helping the volunteers and doing all this and that and staying at the finish line. I was the last person at the finish line there waiting for her to come.
Yeah.
In my sleeping bag trying to stay away from those hordes of mosquitoes, wishing I was running.
Yeah, really. So now you have a family, you have a kid. Would you think about backpacking? Because that's the normal way to do this trail is to backpack in a few days.
Absolutely. You know, I would love to take my, I have a daughter who's like 4.5 months, and I'd love to take her backpacking the trail. In fact, that's one of them that I'd love to do this summer with her.
It is kind of the classic South Central Alaska backpacking trip.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
One of those quintessential backpacking trips. In
well, hopefully we've inspired a few people to go out, even if not to run it, but to go out and enjoy it. It's such a gorgeous trail. And I want to really thank my guest, Laren Thomas. He's the race director of, what's the exact name of the race?
The Resurrection Pass Ultra Races.
Right, and you'll be able to find a, their website on ours at alaskapublic.org. We'll have a link there, and thanks very much for being with us, Laren.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was great to be here.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Monica Goki. Before we move into the second half of the show, I want to share a little something with you. Are you having fun? That's Vern. He's my son. And when he was 4 months old, my husband and I took him up to the Lost Lake Trail, baby's first backpacking trip. It was in May.
Talk about mommy brain. We were going into this cabin, some friends of ours reserved it, and ended up, one of them had to work. So we're headed into this cabin, which I thought was on Resurrection Pass Trail, but it turns out it's not. I didn't realize that till this morning. So Dale Clemens cabin is a little bit of a misfit for a show on the Resurrection Pass Trail, but same neck of the woods regardless.
And we actually never made it to the Dale Clemens cabin on that trip. When we got above the tree line, there was still way more snow than we expected. After post-holing for about a mile, we called it. We turned back and headed for the car. Things were not going very well by then, and like a radio rookie, I stopped recording. I think my husband and I were each feeling kind of like sissies. You know, we'd done a lot of stuff in the outdoors, and not being able to make it into a cabin for some overnight camping, which would be kind of a cushy trip, you know, under other circumstances, well, it felt like a little bit of a failure. But the venture wasn't without its merits. You know, we learned a bit about backpacking with a baby. And I think the big takeaway for us was that you really can't feel bad about bagging a trip if your baby isn't having fun. Babies are, after all, our darling little prisoners when we take them in the outdoors. And if they're not enjoying it, odds are slim that the rest of the family is enjoying things too. And so there you have it. That's a short lesson from the Lost Lake Trail, which we swear to attempt again next year. I'm Monica Goki. Da 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 bum da 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 bum 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 bum. Rocks through the treetops all day long, puffing and a puffing and a singing his song. All the little babies on 17th Street love to hear the baby go peep, peep, peep. Backpacking baby. Beep, 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 beep.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 8 on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about the Resurrection Trail, which is just such a great way to get outdoors, probably the best and certainly the most famous of our trail hikes in Alaska. We have so much open country that we hike above treeline in our state, but we do have some terrific trail hikes, that and the Resurrection Trail is such a good one for a family backpacking trip. You can do it mountain biking. It's a great winter trail. And in the first half, we were hearing about some of the kind of hardcore way of doing it. You know, you don't have to do it in one day. It's actually kind of amazingly difficult to do it in one day. But in the second half, we're going to talk more about how to do the Resurrection Trail just as a regular person, and also some of the history of it and some of the facts you need if you're planning a trip. And my guest is Irene Lundquist, who's with the U.S. Forest Service. She's a forest technician. She's in Moose Pass. And she has a great job because she gets to spend lots of time out hiking, right? Right, Irene?
Yes, I sure do.
So do you sort of like hike up and down the trail and just see what's going on? Or what's your work day like out there in working with the trail?
Well, in the summer, I actually hire trail rangers that do quite a bit of the traveling in the backcountry for me. They'll go out day trips, overnight trips, and we hit all the various locations on our Seward Ranger District, and then I actually get out more doing trail condition and bridge surveys, and after I finish what I've got on my schedule for the summer, then I join my trail rangers on trail rangering and recon trips.
So let's talk about the usage. What is the level of use that the trail gets through the winter? Is it, or through the course of the year? Probably summers are by far the most, I would think.
Yes, and we're looking at, you know, I've looked at use numbers over the years, and and this is just, you know, an estimate because we don't have actual, you know, concrete, but just from what we collect at trailheads and what we see out in the field, you're probably talking about 25,000 users, and May, June, July, and August are big months for people recreating, and you're probably looking at about 4,000 people a month.
Wow. So you're going to see people out there, though. I mean, it's never crowded, I suppose, but people are always using it. Primarily people do it as a through hike, I would think, rather than just hiking in one in and out again. Or tell me, that's a guess on my part.
It really varies. You've got so many different options and different ways to travel. A lot go in maybe the south and come back out, or south to north all the way through, or up Devil's Creek and out south, or just so many variables there.
Yeah. So just to refresh everybody's memory, there's a trailhead in Hope, there's a trailhead in Cooper Landing, and then the Devil's Pass trailhead kind of comes off from the midpoint and descends down to the Seward Highway up around, well, where does it, near Summit Lake, or where does it?
It's just south of Summit Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And the Devil's Creek Trail is a 10-mile access trail. You can, if you take that and go out the southern end, you can do a 27-mile hike, bike, or whatnot. And if you take it out north, it's more like 31 and a half miles.
Okay. And how many cabins, public use cabins, are on the trail?
There are 8 public use cabins that are accessible from the trail, and then there's a 9th cabin at the far west end of Swan Lake, but you wouldn't want to try to hike to that. It'd be extremely rough. That's mainly a winter or a fly-in use cabin.
Oh, okay. So for... I didn't even know about that one. Okay. So, and are these cabins super competitive in terms of reserving them, where you kind of need to be online 6 months ahead to grab them?
You do. They're extremely competitive for end of May through August. If you're not on that 6 months in advance, good chance you won't be able to get what you want. Come September, October, use really lightens up. May, it's pretty light. And then winter, you know, depending if it's a motorized winter season or not. When it's a motorized season, the cabins are a little bit more competitive, the ones on the southern end. The ones on the northern end, they're generally open a bit more, but that's because getting to them, it's more advanced intermediate snow machine rider.
In other words, that steep section, which we talked about in the first half, which leads down to Cooper Landing, it would be more challenging on a snow machine to do that.
It is, because you've got a lot of drainages that you drop into and climb out of that are on narrow side hills, and when you get the snow packed, quite often it's packed at an angle, so negotiating those drainages is very difficult.
Right. So what is the spacing of the cabins? And if someone did want to plan a backcountry trip, I guess it would depend on how fast and how far you wanted to go, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to take your first choice, because it's so hard to get those reservations with the online system, which, by the way, folks can find on our website, alaskapublic.org. Click on today's show on the Resurrection Pass, and you'll find a link to the National Reservation System for cabins, which I hope everybody knows about already. But in any event, how are those cabins spaced, and how do you plan a trip? What's the best way to do that?
Okay, well, you would need to figure out how far you could comfortably backpack in a day. You know, what is your use level? And we've got cabins at 7.5 mile, and I'm going from the southern trailhead in Cooper Landing. 7.5 miles, 9 miles, 9.5 miles, 13 miles, almost 17 miles, and that one is at Devil's Pass. And then from Hope, you've got one at 7 miles, that's Caribou Creek, and then Fox Creek is almost 12 miles, and East Creek is almost 14.5 miles in.
Okay.
And then Devil's Pass from Hope is just about 22 miles.
So that number of cabins over a 30-some-mile trail is actually quite a lot of cabins, so they're pretty, it's not that far in between.
Correct. I have done this trail a number of times with my children, and starting when the youngest was 4 years old, and I've really enjoyed using the cabins, but this year I was not able to get the Devil's Pass cabin, so we had a long day hike from Swan Lake over to East Creek Cabin. That's about a 10-mile, and it doesn't seem like it's that far, but when you add your backpack and all that weight and you're taking younger children, it's a bit more of a distance, but it certainly is doable by taking your time and having lots of high-energy snacks.
Right. Well, and people don't realize that when you've got kids, you actually have vastly increased the amount of stuff you're carrying.
it makes it more
challenging rather than less.
It does, but it's so rewarding.
Totally. Yeah.
A wonderful experience, and definitely worth the time to plan and make it work.
Well, and we're sort of gotten into backpacking, but as a backpacking trip, how many days would you plan to do the Resurrection Trail at a reasonable rate? You know, something that maybe elementary school kids wouldn't get too worn out. Would you do it like a 4-day, or what do you think?
I would probably go. I'd go 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
At a minimum, that'd be 4 nights and 5 days. But quite often, I'll do it 5 nights. And 6 days, and that 5 nights allows for one down day, so you're at one cabin for 2 nights in a row. And I like to do it like at Juneau Lake, though I've done it up at Devil's Pass Cabin, just so you've got one day to relax and not pack up and have to move on. But then that also means that you're carrying that much more food with you.
Right. So, is it possible to, are there good camping spots along the way if you haven't managed to score one of these cabins?
Yes. We have got, right now we've got 16 designated campsites. And those campsites, some of them have the bear-proof food lockers, some of them have pit toilets, and all of them have an adequate source of water that you can filter, drinking water.
And so there you don't need to make a reservation. You can just say, you know, a week ahead, hey, let's do Resurrection Pass next week and head out there and do it.
Yes. And those designated campsites, some are rather large, some are a little smaller, but it sure makes it a lot easier for getting out there and backpacking and not having to figure out where you want to stop next.
Right. Yeah. And that spontaneity is fun, especially when you get a whiny kid who you don't think you can make it to the next cabin. Just stop and set up your tent.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the Resurrection Pass Trail today on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and my guest is Irene Lindquist, who's with the Tregaska National Forest, and she's in Moose Pass, and she has the job of sort of overseeing the trail and taking care of it for us. And so really glad that you're there doing that job. And it's a really interesting topic. It's really making me want to get out there and do the trail again. So, Irene, we talked a little bit about different modes for using the trail. Summer, of course, would primarily be backpacking, although we talked in the first half with Laren Thomas about running. Wintertime, more choices. There's motorized use on snowmobiles, and then there's snowshoeing and skiing. How does that work? How do you guys manage the, you know, potentially conflicting uses of the motorized and non-motorized?
Okay, well, we, over the course of time and with the forest plan, have a, actually it's not new, we've been doing this for about 7-8 years now. Motorized use is allowed on that trail system when your winter season in December begins in an odd year. So this year, December is in 2015, that's an odd year, is allowed, is a a motorized season.
So this is a motorized winter that's coming up in 15, 16. Mm-hmm.
And then, so then the following year, when it's an even year, 2016, December 1st, that'll be a non-motorized season. And, you know, you still have skiers that go out, and actually, I really enjoy when snow machines are allowed on the trail, because from the southern end anyways, it's typically a packed trail, though you do get the moguls on it. But with it being packed and a little wider, I've done quite a bit of skate skiing and ski joring up there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it really gets packed.
Mm-hmm. It sure does. From the southern end. From the northern end, it doesn't get as much motorized use just because of the difficult side hill drainages.
Okay, now let me make sure I understand. So the southern end from Cooper Landing gets more or less? I thought, I was under the impression it got less because it was steeper.
Oh, no, so I need to explain there. So from Cooper Landing, it gets more use, but you don't go from the summer hiking trail. You go, we've got two accesses that provide pretty easy access. One's off of Bean Creek Slaughter Ridge Road, and one is West Juneau Road. And we've got directions. If you look at our website, we have directions to either of those trailheads that provide a much easier access up into Resurrection Pass.
I got it. We were talking about the cabin, so that makes sense. And then the northern end from Hope, the snow machine crowd is not as interested in that?
No, just because it's a bit more difficult access.
I see.
From Hope.
And so, you've spent time skiing out there, and you don't feel like you're sort of bummed out by too many snow machines running around?
No, and I know there are people that might get a little more bummed just because of the noise and smell and want the quiet time, but I actually prefer them to be out there so I can take my skate skis and really cruise, especially if I've got one of my dogs with me.
For sure. And if somebody wants to bring their snow machine down, is there the snow cover regulations, and how do they find out if snow cover is adequate?
Yes. We like to have enough snow, and it's not necessarily a snowfall amount or how many inches is on the ground. First, if we've got a good ice layer, a really good base, and then snow cover that adds up and covers the vegetation, and will typically open the trail. But, you know, this last winter, actually it was a non-motorized year, but we never did open any of our district, unfortunately, to motorized because we didn't receive adequate snow cover, you know, with a decent base. So what you can do, if you look online, the Chugach National Forest main webpage under Recreation and Trails, we try to post that and keep that up to date, you know, if the trail is open. And you can always call our main office in Seward, 224-3374.
Okay. Any tips for folks who want to set up a family snow machine expedition over the trail, or things to be sort of aware of? It's August now, and that seems like a long way off, but really, if you're going to reserve cabins and plan a, you know, a significant outdoor trip, it's not too early to be thinking about it.
Right. Yes. you can certainly book your cabin now. Winter, they're generally open a little bit more, not as competitive as summertime. But as you get closer to your trip, if we are open for motorized use, you're going to want to give us a call. There's a few of us that are around in the winter that can return phone calls, you know, later in the day, so we can give you an idea of what conditions are like, because quite often going up into there, if it warms up and rains, even though we may be open to motorized, you might not be able to get there very easy unless you've got a snow machine, like with the skegs on them, you know, the spikes on the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
It gets extremely icy, but we might be able to help you out, give you a few pointers. If you can't go up Bean Creek, you could travel a little further to go up West Juneau Road, which doesn't ice up as much. But I'd say before your trip, a few days before, a week before, give us a call so that we can give you the latest conditions.
Okay.
And then, of course, hopefully you'll have some experience with snow machines and hauling trailers and all the tools and things that you need to prepare and take with you, because quite often, you know, depending on the extremes in the weather, you can get down, and this is hard to believe because of our last couple winters have been so warm, but I have been out there when it's been minus 20, and it's a challenge to stay warm. And when I go up, my family, my husband will take a snow machine and a chainsaw and spend quite a bit of time cutting firewood. And even before we get there, we'll bring usually a night's supply of firewood with us, just so we know that we've got plenty to get the stove going.
Yeah. Well, you get into a cold cabin, it takes a while to warm it up, even with a blazing fire. And so we kind of assume that people know what they're doing before they head out on the stuff we talk about, but that's a really good point, that you don't want to plan a multi-day trip with your family on your snow machine until you're pretty sure you're confident of your skills.
Yes.
Right. So what about mountain biking? How does that fit in with everything else on the Resurrection Trail?
Well, mountain biking is very popular. Next to the hiking, I'd say mountain biking's right up there. And year-round, you know, people are getting out with their fat tire bikes, and especially if you've got studded tires for your bike in the winter. Summertime, you know, depending on the kind of rider you are, you can travel it in a day, which actually I prefer to do rather than biking and trailering, though. For work, sometimes I'll take a trailer and go overnight. Traveling in one day, if you're an experienced rider, that's certainly a doable thing. But if you're not an experienced rider, attempting that over 38 miles in a day can be pretty harsh on you, and especially if conditions are wet and muddy. This summer it's been a pretty bomber trail tread because it's been so dry, so it's been relatively easy.
Right. And so again, if you're going to plan to cycle it, you probably need to know that you can do that distance. Otherwise, you'll be stuck out, you know, at night, unprepared. And then whatever you do, you're going to have to pre-position a vehicle at either end so you can get back, unless you can really do it down and back, you know, do almost an 80-mile ride over rough terrain, which is kind of an extreme activity.
Yeah, like the Soggy Bottom race. Yes, you don't want to be attempting this if you've not ridden distances on some of our trails before, and you want to be prepared. And I know, you know, people do attempt it and aren't as prepared, but that's not a good thing to do. You want to be sure you've got your wind and rain layers with you, and lots of snacks and your bike tools, and just be prepared for your breakdowns and spending time out there. It doesn't always go as smooth as it should. And I know we've been out there where we've helped people that weren't very prepared, you know, with helping them with their bikes, giving them tools and getting them on their way.
So there are no regulations that, like there are with winter, that bikes are only allowed at certain times. It's just people just being polite and trying to get along together between the hikers and the bikers.
Correct.
Okay.
Right now, there aren't any regulations, and we just ask that the bikers be respectful of hikers and respectful of the ground conditions, and especially early in the spring, if it's a late snow melt year, we just ask bikers to wait and stay off the trails that are getting really muddy or are really muddy until things dry out. And this year was really nice because things were very dry and pretty hardened by mid-May.
Yeah, and I feel like most bikers are pretty polite. I don't know if what your sense is, you know, that people will kind of be aware that you don't whiz by a hiker and let them know that you're coming and let them know how many more cyclists are behind you. I mean, what are your feelings? Are there any conflicts between the two?
You know, you have some here or there, but I'd say for the most part, the bikers are definitely very polite and do everything they can do to get out of your way. And I'd say that for the snow machiners also. I know I've had people on snowmobile go out of their way to get off the trail, and they end up getting stuck, and I tell them, no, you're fine. But really polite users, I would say.
Yeah, good. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this issue of pre-positioning your car and how long it takes to drive back and forth, because if you're planning a day, that really adds to sort of the hours that you need to plan and a little bit to your fatigue. So you driving, you know, if whichever end you're starting from, whether you're starting from Hope or from Cooper Landing or from Devil's Creek, you need to have two cars and one parked at each end. And so that means a lot of over and back driving. How long does it take to drive from one end of the trail to the other?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. From Cooper Landing, you're looking at a good hour and a half, 2 hours, and depending on the road construction, you know, how you catch that and what stops you get caught in. But from Anchorage, Hope is 85 miles, and Cooper Landing from Anchorage is 106 miles. So that's quite a bit of distance.
Yeah. So that's just something to factor in, because otherwise you could find you don't have enough time for what you want to do. Yeah. Are the cars pretty safe in these trailheads? Have you had robberies or is...
We have in the past. It seems that it kind of comes and goes. I haven't heard of any break-ins, though, in the last several summers.
Oh, well, that's great. That's good to hear.
It is really good to hear. I know in the past there have been problems, and I've actually, my car was stolen from the Lower Russian Lake Trailhead 1 year.
Wow.
Yeah, they found the hidden key and stole the car, and a few months later they did find the car up a side road there in Cooper Landing.
Wow, that's strange, isn't it?
But that's pretty rare.
Yeah, so, and it's not a great idea to leave a lot of valuables in your car at a trailhead under any circumstances.
Right.
Yeah. So we've got a few minutes left. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about the Resurrection Trail today with Irene Lundquist, who's a forest technician in Moose Pass and kind of takes care of the trail for us. In the time we have left, I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of the trail and also how it connects to the trail that runs onward to Seward, which I don't even know if it's open at this point, so you can maybe fill me in on that. So the Iditarod Trail originally started in Seward and ran, you know, and this was a part of it, right? Or was that the Johnson Pass Trail that was part of the Iditarod
Trail? Johnson Pass Trail.
Okay, so this is the trail that was used for the Gold Rush and Sunrise and Hope for people to get there, right?
Correct. So
okay.
In the mid-1800s, the gold mining was really taking off, and on the northern end of Resurrection Pass Trail. So gold miners would go up some of the side drainages like Colorado, Pass Creek, dropping into Fox Creek. And it wasn't until actually 1961 that construction began on the Bean Creek Trail, which is on the southern end near Cooper Landing. And that would link the southern trail to the northern trail.
Huh.
And then 1971, the trailhead, as you know it, there near mile 53 of the Sterling Highway, that trail was constructed. So it wasn't until your 70s that you had a trail going all the way across the top.
Wow,
and
I didn't know that.
The trail, that you're talking about linking down to Resurrection River, I know you will see some publications here and there on the internet that say, oh, you can do this 70-mile hike from Hope down to Seward. However, we don't recommend that. The Resurrection River Trail, which you pick up from the Russian Lakes Trail, that Resurrection River Trail is more of a primitive trail. We sometimes will cut the trees from it, though this year we didn't cut the trees off of it just because we couldn't get across Martin and Boulder Creeks. Those bridges were washed out in that was the mid-90s, Typhoon Austin.
That's what I was thinking. Now, back in the 90s, it was doable, and then there was that flood, and those bridges got destroyed, yeah, and they were never rebuilt.
Never rebuilt, and it's just more of a, the trail tread is rougher, the brush is just horrendous, and you wouldn't want to mountain bike it, though I do know a couple really gung-ho, hardy mountain bikers that have taken their bikes on it. But you wouldn't even really want to backpack it unless you are, you know, prepared to do major bushwhacking and stream crossings. And
some people think that's fun, but most don't.
No. And if you did want to attempt that, I would recommend starting from the Seward end, just in case you don't make it across those fords of Martin and Boulder Creeks.
Okay.
So you're not too far in on the trail.
All right. Well, this has been really fun. I've learned a lot, and I'm super excited about getting back out on the Resurrection Trail. I want to thank you, Irene Lundquist, who's a forest technician with the Tugash National Forest in Moose Pass. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Charles.
And we'll make sure to have Irene's, the Forest Service website where you can find information about the trail and how to get in touch with the rangers and also the reservation system for the cabins out on the Resurrection Trail. I also want to thank my guest in the first half, Laren Thomas, who was talking to us about the Resurrection Trail Pass Ultra Races. And that's all we have for today. Tune in again next week. We're going to be having a show on Arctic paddling. You might have heard it in the evening a couple of weeks ago, but we didn't play during the day, so we want to make sure you hear that one. So please tune in. And Outdoor Explorer is produced by Monica Goki. Grace Bogine is our production assistant who lines up guests. I'm Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with us. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.